Ukraine, the release of her new book, The Bush Agenda. She is a leading expert on international trade and finance policy. She has served as a congressional aide to John Conyers and as a project director of the International Forum on Globalization. She is currently a visiting scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. In The Bush Agenda, Antonia reveals the history and key role of U.S. corporations in the creation of this agenda and provides for readers thoughtful, sustainable, and achievable alternatives. There'll be time afterwards, after the presentation, for Q&A. Please welcome Antonia Juhas.
Thank you all so much for coming. It's all my family and friends. This is wonderful. Thanks, everybody. It's going to be a pleasure if I can find some space to get started. Filtered water for author, not for anybody else. is this making my voice louder? Good. Thank you all so much. So first, I want to thank Modern Times very, very much. And I want to make a big plug. I have done a number of these events now. I've been on tour for about 2.5 weeks. And one of the things that I have found is that people come to the events and then go home and buy the book from Amazon, which is understandable because it is less expensive. Whoa. But there is something that you get by paying your extra money, by supporting your local bookstore. You get to have events like this where you get to come out and have conversations with the author. You get to support all the diversity that exists within Modern Times Bookstore and all the history and a local community center, essentially, that we are experiencing right now. So please, if you intend to buy the book, buy it here, buy it tonight, and support Modern Times. And you get my signature, so. Yeah, I need a job, actually. So, let's see. The first thing I want to say is that having been on tour for 2.5 weeks, one of the things that I mentioned, it's been 2.5 weeks, and I'm a little tired. One of the things that I have heard repeatedly in the very wonderful reception that the Bush Agenda has received is that it is chock full of facts, and that's one of the things that makes it the most useful to activists and to activists in waiting. And that would not have been possible, particularly in the time frame within which I had to write the book, were it not for the incredible assistance of my research assistant, Sam Edmondson, who's back there. Stand up, Sam. Stand up. Yay, there he is. Thanks, Sam. Just incredible research skills, and Sam is also an activist, as am I, and between the two of us, we were able to really get the necessary information and then put it forward in a way that I think is empowering. And that's one of the best things that I've discovered, is that people are not depressed by this information, and it can be very depressing. They're empowered by it, because the entire thrust of the book is how our movements are succeeding already in dismantling the Bush agenda, and how by gaining more information, we can apply that information to expand our successes. And the book is filled with my own stories of being a participant in the global justice movement for some 10 years, in all the amazing things that I've seen from Beirut to Mexico to Bolivia to all across the United States and lots of other places as well. So that is the spirit within which I wrote the book and within which I offer it now. There are seats in here. Earth, you have to sit up front, sorry. That's what you get for coming in late. And that's the spirit within which I'm gonna offer this discussion tonight. I decided to write this book following up on the amazing anti-war activism that many, many people in this room were a part of with the Organizing for Direct Action to Stop the War. In that organizing, we chose very specifically to target corporations, corporations that were profiting off of the war, and corporations that seemed to have a very large role in the reasons for why we were at war in the first place. And those companies that we targeted here were our local companies, Bechtel, of course, just down the street that way, Chevron, just up the road, I think, that way. Someone has good sense of direction. That way. Thank you, David. Lockheed Martin. That way. I just walk. I don't drive, so I don't know where things are. It's, you know, that's what you get. And Lockheed Martin. Of course, Halliburton was ever present in our sights, and those are the four companies that I focused on in the book. As I started doing the research, I realized that we were absolutely correct in our choice of targets. That these companies, in addition to profiting off this war, were that their profit was not random. That it was not random that these were four companies that were profiting far greater than other companies that seemed to be ever present in the invasion, in the occupation. That these four companies actually had a very strong interrelated connection to the Bush administration, but even more importantly, to Iraq, and had been involved in working in Iraq, trying to gain a greater foothold in Iraq for many, many decades, and in some cases all the way back to 1916, in the case of Chevron, one of the very first oil companies operating in Iraq, and one of the very first oil companies operating in the Middle East, U.S. oil companies, actually. So I began to look at who were the companies, what was this relationship, and what was or is the Bush administration and these companies after? What is it that they want? What does Iraq mean to them? What's next to inform our activism, to inform my own activism? And what I discovered, maybe not surprisingly, is a more intricate web than I had expected to see. And that web took me back looking at the key players of the Bush administration, Cheney, Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld, Bush Sr., Bush Jr., Condoleezza Rice, Libby, Edelman, Pearl, Powell a little bit, and took me back to the Nixon administration, where many of them had begun working together, and led me to look at this ridiculous, constant shift between the multinational corporate sector and the government sector that these men in particular, but also Condoleezza Rice, had played and continued to play, and how that guided their political choices. Three documents that I focus on in trying to understand the agenda, the political thinking of these men and these companies are pretty familiar, I think, to those of us on the left. The defense planning guidance from 1992 at the very tail end of the Bush Senior administration, is that familiar to folks? Some, not everybody, okay. The Project for the New American Century and the writings of the Project for the New American Century, okay, fabulous. The left has been doing its work. And the National Security Strategy of the Bush Administration, 2002. Good. Okay. So I'm going to go back a little bit into the defense planning guidance. What I do differently in the book, again, to answer my own questions, was to look at these documents and to say, what is the economic agenda here? Not just the military, which has received and should receive a tremendous amount of attention, but what is the economic agenda, and is it articulated in these documents in the same way as the military agenda is? And what I discovered going back to the 1992 defense planning guidance, as I said, was written at the very tail end of the Bush senior administration. And it was written by Cheney and Wolfowitz and Team Wolfowitz, which is what I call them, which is Libby, who was Wolfowitz's student at Yale. I'm not going to remember this stuff off the top of my head, darn it. Edelman, Khalilzad. Khalilzad actually started the Reagan administration working under Wolfowitz, and Zalmay Khalilzad is the current U.S. ambassador to Iraq. And all these men worked together to draft this document, which really was the very first cell phone call. The house phone. Turn off the darn house phone. Jeez, talk going on here. The defense planning guidance was the first post-Cold War paper to come out. That's so annoying. I'm sorry. Okay, I can think. To come out after the fall of the Soviet Union with the attempt to define what is the United States' role now in the post-Soviet world. And there was a very strong attempt to have that definition be about a peace dividend, that we were no longer fighting a Cold War. We now would have billions of dollars available to us to do things like pay for health care for everybody in America, implement a very strong social welfare state. There were very concrete examples put forward, paying for education, paying for child care, that this would be our dividend for winning the Cold War. Well, instead, the authors of the Defense Planning Guidance said, no, what we really need to do is solidify our superpower status. We need to go beyond just being the most powerful country in the world. We need to lock in that power. And we can lock in that power best in the Middle East by securing our continued guaranteed access to Middle East oil, which will also help us spread our influence. We need to act as much as possible unilaterally. We'll only work with other countries when it serves our interest to do so. We need to feel free to act preemptively in war, and the difference between preventative war and preemptive war has received a lot of attention, but quickly, preemptive war is allowed through international law, and that is basically, there's troops amassing at your border, they're going to come and invade, and you're going to preempt them from invading, and that's allowed in international law. What the defense planning guidance laid out in 1992 was preventative war. We think that someone somewhere, did I flip it, Moulton?
Yeah.
Okay, flip it the other way around. We think that someone somewhere is thinking about doing us harm, and therefore we are justified in acting. And that was the position laid out in the 1992 Defense Planning Guidance, not protected by international law, because anyone can say that someone somewhere is thinking of maybe doing them harm. This and many other elements of the Defense Planning Guidance clearly became the policies put forward by this current Bush administration. Let me back up a little bit. One thing that is also dominant in the writing of each of these men is the interest in Iraq. And one of the things that receives, I don't think, enough attention is the relationship between, the economic relationship between the United States and Iraq prior to the first Gulf War. So these four companies that I focused on, Bechtel, Lockheed, Chevron, and Halliburton, played prominent roles in two lobbying groups. One is the U.S.-Iraq Business Forum, which started meeting the same year that President Reagan opened up economic relations between the United States and Iraq, and Kissinger Associates. Kissinger Associates is uniquely skilled in keeping the clients that Mr. Kissinger works with secret. And actually almost everything that they do secret. The most recent article I could find in an actual discussion with Henry Kissinger about his business, Kissinger Associates, was written in 1986. And between Sam and I, we have some pretty darn good research skills, and I'm pretty sure that's the most recent article. Now, Kissinger Associates, we know, works on behalf of multinational corporations to help open up access to them around the world. Kissinger Associates, the U.S.-Iraq Business Forum, met regularly with Saddam Hussein and Tariq Aziz trying to increase U.S. economic relationships with Iraq, and they were very successful. But they were only a little bit successful compared to Bush Sr. I'm going to read one quote. Okay, the end of the Iran-Iraq War in 1988 offered the newly elected Bush administration a fresh opportunity to alter U.S. relations with Iraq. Bush's transition team provided the president-elect with a policy memo on Iraq, which explained that Saddam Hussein, this is quote, Saddam Hussein will continue to eliminate those he regards as a threat, torture those he believes have secrets to reveal, and rule without any real concessions to democracy. They argued, however, that engagement with Iraq was the appropriate response. The United States would have to, quote, decide whether to treat Iraq as a distasteful dictatorship to be shunned where possible, or to recognize Iraq's present and potential power in the region and accord it relatively high priority. We, the authors, strongly urge the latter view. Two reasons offered in the paper were Iraq's, quote, vast oil reserves, which promise a lucrative market for U.S. goods, and the fact that U.S. oil imports from Iraq were skyrocketing. In fact, the Bush senior administration was extremely successful in opening up Iraq to U.S. businesses. All of our friends, Halliburton, Lockheed, Bechtel, and Chevron. And let me read some statistics. In 1981, there was almost no trade between the United States and Iraq. In 1989, Iraq became the United States' second largest trading partner in the Middle East. In 1989, the U.S. bought $5.5 billion in Iraqi petroleum. And between 1987 and 1990, U.S. consumption of Iraqi oil increased from 80,000 to 675,000 barrels of oil a day, and then increased again to 1.1 million barrels per day in July 1990. In fact, right before, literally as Saddam Hussein was crossing into Kuwait, the Bush senior administration was working on a $1 billion loan guarantee to get to Saddam Hussein so that he could purchase more U.S. goods and products. He was trying to build a very tight economic relationship. In addition, let me step back a little bit, talk about Bechtel in particular. This back and forth relationship between the U.S. government and these corporations. So for example, George Shultz, our own local George Shultz, was a president of the Bechtel Corporation for 8 years. He then left Bechtel to become Reagan's Secretary of State. As Reagan's Secretary of State, he lobbied aggressively against or with Saddam Hussein to try and win a pipeline deal for Bechtel to build an oil pipeline to get oil out of Iraq through the port of Aqaba, Jordan. That deal fell through. That was one of the first signs that things were going sour with Saddam Hussein. However, Bechtel was successful in building and managing a petrochemical complex in Iraq, which manufactured the precursor to mustard gas, and was probably quite helpful in helping Saddam Hussein and his little side project of using chemical weapons against his own people and the Iranian people. The relationship, however, was clearly thrown asunder when Hussein invaded Kuwait. At that point, I think we heard probably the last time a President Bush was at least somewhat honest in his reasons for invading Iraq. On August 15th, President Bush, 1990, President Bush declared, quote, "Our jobs, our way of life, our own freedom, and the freedom of friendly countries around the world would all suffer if control of the world's great oil reserves fell into the hands of Saddam Hussein." To this, Secretary Baker added, "The economic lifeline of the industrial world runs from the Gulf, and we cannot permit a dictator such as this to sit astride that economic lifeline." For 10 years, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, Cheney, and Wolfowitz and Khalilzad in particular, articulated the need to not only invade Iraq, not only replace Saddam Hussein, but to just get rid of all of this back and forth fighting with these dictators and instead fundamentally transform the economic and political infrastructure of Iraq so that U.S. corporate access would be locked in instead of having to worry about the vicissitudes of this dictator or that dictator. So we've got some really wonderful, we meaning I, quotes about them stating quite simply the need to invade Iraq, get greater access to Iraq's oil, and that these economic underpinnings were the reasons for going into the war. Then to go back to these documents. The 1992 Defense Planning Guidance was sort of a document, hammered on the door as the senior Bush administration walked out. And in such did not really reflect Bush Sr.'s positions. It was really the positions of his underlings, Cheney, Wolfowitz, and the like. 16 of people who would become key members of the Bush administration, and there are some chairs up here for people standing, and there's chairs over there that can be opened up. Don't be shy. There's water up here, but just for me. Speaking of which, 16 of these people would become key members of the Bush administration, participated during the 8 years of the Clinton administration in the Project for the New American Century. Now, the Project for the New American Century famously wrote in its key document, Rebuilding America's Defenses, that the United States was and needed to continue to be a Pax Americana. Now, I was really intrigued by this phrase, Pax Americana, so I spent about 10 pages in the book discussing the Pax Romana, which is what the Pax Americana is a reference to. And the Pax Romana is, I believe, the sort of mythical belief that Rome was able to maintain world peace by being so militarily and economically dominant and so successful at stealing all those resources from all those different countries across the world, that world peace was maintained because nobody would even feel that they could even think about questioning Rome. And that we in the United States not only have a Pax Americana, but this is what we want to maintain. Now, I say it's mythical because, I kind of alluded to it, I think it's mythical. Clearly, Rome wasn't peaceful for anyone who didn't really want to be a party to the Roman Empire. Rome also wasn't very peaceful to anyone who didn't want to turn over all of their resources to the empire. In addition, Rome ran on 50% slave labor. It wasn't particularly peaceful for the 50% of the population that were the slaves. Rome was also an empire ruled by an emperor, which meant it was a dictatorship, which meant that there was absolutely no civil participation. So there's many reasons why I think that the model of the Pax Romana is somewhat problematic and makes me worry a little bit that that's what these guys are clearly intent on putting forward. And in fact, they use the term Pax Americana 19 times in this document, and even more if you count the sort of different twists of the term. My favorite was the benevolent empire that America would be creating. I thought that was good. What is less paid attention to is the focus in this document on the economic expansion of the American empire. That expanding the American empire wasn't just about increasing defense spending by $15 to $20 billion annually, which is what they asked for. And how many people know how much money we're spending every month on the war in Iraq? $10 billion a month. So these guys have far surpassed even their own wildest dreams for the expenditure on the U.S. military. But that we would spread the U.S. economic model as well. And that model increasingly gets defined as the expansion of free trade. And literally, 9 days after September 11th, the U.S. Trade Representative Robert Zoellick, who's now the Undersecretary of State, announced that we would be countering terror with trade, and that free trade would be the mechanism by which we would spread freedom around the world and challenge the terrorists and take them down and spread this U.S. economic Pax Americana around the world, and everything will be great and peaceful. In the book, I go into an entire chapter of why corporate globalization is a failed model. I also go through an entire chapter of why these corporations in particular, Chevron, Halliburton, Lockheed Martin, and Bechtel, actually, if anything, really need to be probably more regulated than they actually are. And of course, for me, corporate globalization policies are, if they're about anything, they are about reducing as much as possible our means of regulating corporate activity in any form. So that's in there for folks who need it, and I'm going to make, I think, the fairly safe assumption that I don't need to go into that here. It was very troubling for me as a global justice advocate to see that free trade was going to be the way that we were going to be combating terrorism, and it made me very, very afraid. So I started paying more attention to this free trade focus of the Bush administration, and it actually amounted to and amounts to an extremely radical and unique approach to corporate globalization policy. And there's two reasons for this. The first is Robert Zoellick became the U.S. Trade Representative at a time when we were being incredibly successful. The global justice movement had radicalized the concept of what free trade was, had exposed the reality of what free trade was, had united in unprecedented ways around the world to challenge the World Trade Organization, to fundamentally stymie the World Trade Organization, to challenge the World Bank, to challenge the International Monetary Fund, to challenge the very premise of free trade. We were meeting by the hundreds and thousands every time they met. We were stopping them every time they met to negotiate agreements. Hundreds of thousands of us were meeting for the World Social Forum, et cetera. September 11th then provided a tremendous opportunity to say to the world, you have to play by our economic ball or you'll be shown to be with the terrorists. And so the very first and now only successful ministerial meeting of the WTO for years was the meeting in Qatar just a month after September 11th, where Robert Zoellick went to all of the countries meeting at the WTO and said, look, this is the situation. You sign on or everyone will know where you stand. And the countries signed on, and they weren't going to. And that ministerial went forward. Now, the place where all of these ideas would really come together would be with the invasion of Iraq. And as I've said, and as I say in the book, this clear agenda moving towards the invasion of Iraq was very clear in the writings of all of these folks. Then in the 2002 National Security Strategy published by the Bush administration, the president devoted a full one-third of his national security strategy to discussing his free trade agenda. And he directly linked his free trade agenda with his expansion of the national security interests of the United States, and made clear that the United States would be willing to use its military to advance its economic interests. And then, of course, this came to brutal play in Iraq. Now, let me take another quick step back. This is the first time in American history that the president, vice president, and secretary of state are all former energy or oil company executives. Both Bush and Condoleezza Rice have more experience running oil companies than they do working as government officials. It is well known that Rice has an oil tanker named after her. It is less well known that she earned it. She spent 10 years working at Chevron on the board of directors, directing their policy committee. She's deeply intertwined with this company, and she has a large debt to pay to society for her work at the head of Chevron. The oil and energy sector also donated 13 times more money to the Bush-Cheney ticket in 2000 than to its challengers, and they've gotten what they've paid for. They've gotten the war for oil, they've gotten subsidies, they've gotten tax breaks, they've gotten deregulation, they've gotten monopoly power, and obviously this industry, with Chevron at the head, I truly believe, and Halliburton, are key to supporting the Bush agenda and driving it forward. 10 days after Bush came into office, Bush the younger, Cheney organized the Cheney Energy Task Force. The members of the Cheney Energy Task Force, only made public by a Supreme Court suit, included Bechtel, Chevron, Halliburton, and every large oil and gas company in the country. The papers of the Cheney Energy Task Force included a document which was called Foreign Suitors to Iraqi Oil, and it listed some 30 companies from some 60 countries that had contracts with Saddam Hussein for oil in Iraq. Of course, none of these were going to U.S. companies. The only U.S. companies that had any dealings with Saddam Hussein at this point was through the Oil for Food program, and Chevron, always ever present in Iraq, had one of those contracts. However, none of these contracts could come into play while the sanctions were in force. However, global public opinion was turning aggressively against the sanctions because of the brutal impact they were having in Iraq. It was clear the writing on the wall, the sanctions were going to be removed. So the U.S. oil companies said, hey, we got to invade, we got to have a war. So they go to war. They invade Iraq. And this time around, they don't mess around. They remove Saddam Hussein. They implement an entirely new political and economic infrastructure that locks in guaranteed corporate access to Iraq. So I've spoken a lot about this, so I'm going to sort of, and it's, I go to it in detail in the book. I'm going to kind of do the quick paintbrush of how that happened. 2 months prior to the war, it's a myth that the Bush administration had no post-invasion plan. They had a very clear plan, however, it was very limited in its sights. It was an economic restructuring to guarantee corporate access, to guarantee a lock on Iraq's oil. Bearing Point Inc., a Virginia-based company, had a contract 2 months prior to the invasion for $250 million to rewrite the economic infrastructure of Iraq. A State Department working group focused on oil and energy was meeting prior to the invasion to map out the new oil infrastructure of Iraq. One of the members of that oil working group, his name was Bara Olum. He was then appointed by Paul Bremer, who was the administrator of the U.S. occupation government of Iraq, to be one of the first oil ministers of Iraq. And the very first thing that Bara Olum did was cancel all of those pre-existing oil contracts. Those are gone. Paul Bremer then implemented Bearing Point's economic plan to a T on the ground in Iraq, implementing 100 orders, which fundamentally restructured Iraq's economy. Those were then locked in with the new constitution of Iraq, and they are still the law of land in Iraq, including granting 100% immunity to U.S. corporations operating in Iraq from Iraqi law, which means that it's our responsibility, right, to hold those companies accountable, because they can't even begin to do so in Iraq thanks to the Bremer orders. The Bremer orders paved the way for 150 U.S. corporations to receive $50 billion in reconstruction work, $2.8 billion for Bechtel, which they have utterly failed to perform their contractual duties for. They have not rebuilt water, electricity, sewage. They need to pay that money back, and we have to force them to do that. The failure of the reconstruction, of course, led to extreme opposition to the occupation by the people of Iraq, and the very structure of the Bremer orders is what made it impossible for that reconstruction to succeed, because the reconstruction was focused exclusively on U.S. corporate gain and not what would benefit the people of Iraq. So that's one stream. The second stream is the oil stream. So the new oil law is then aggressively put in place and advocated for by Abdel Mahdi, who was the first finance minister of Iraq appointed by Bremer. He's now the vice president of Iraq. He was the Bush administration's first choice for the new premier of Iraq, and that was not successful. The new oil law opens up all of Iraq's undeveloped oil fields. So Iraq has 80 known oil fields, 17 are developed. All the rest will be open to private foreign corporate access on terms highly favorable to the foreign private companies, on terms that are not used in any other countries in the Middle East because they're so preferable to the foreign companies. That oil law is set to be implemented. All that they're waiting on is the new government of Iraq to take its permanent seat. The oil companies have already signed some 30 memoranda of understanding. These are agreements. Chevron's been shipping Iraqi oil workers to the United States for years, training them for free, doing all sorts of work on the sidelines so that they're ready to sign the contracts. However, once the contracts are signed, the companies will need security to get to work. And what better security force than 150,000 American troops? So what the Bush administration has succeeded in doing is putting in place an Iraqi government that supports the military occupation, that supports the economic transformation, and that supports the new oil restructuring of Iraq. I think the oil timeline is what is guiding the end of the war. Now that's just one part. 1 month after the invasion, the Bush administration announced plans for a U.S. Middle East free trade area to spread all these economic policies to the rest of the Middle East. and they are succeeding in that endeavor where no other American administration has succeeded before. There is, however, a tremendous lack of information in the Middle East among anti-corporate globalization activists in the Middle East about the negotiation of the U.S. Middle East Free Trade Area. And that, again, is another place where we have a tremendous function to serve. prior to the Qatar ministerial, I, along with several other U.S. activists, went to Beirut, Lebanon to meet with networks of anti-corporate globalization activists in the Middle East. Those networks have suffered tremendously in the post-September 11th, particularly post-Iraq invasion world, and that is something that needs a tremendous amount of attention from all of us. I have received a commitment from my publisher to have my book published by an Arab publisher in the Middle East, and my book will be translated into Arabic, and hopefully I'll be able to go to the Middle East. My boyfriend doesn't want me to do that, so I'm looking over there at him. But that is something, a task that we very much need to take on ourselves, which is the trading of information and working together in those networks. The impacts of the U.S. Middle East Free Trade Area negotiations are hitting quickly. The U.S. Free Trade Area with Jordan, one of the very first agreements signed by the Bush administration, has already had devastating effects. Basically, Jordan has become the new hot zone for cheap labor and sweatshop production. So the new free trade zone in Jordan is where companies such as Walmart, JCPenney, Target, Jones New York are all producing apparel under the absolute worst sweatshop labor conditions that I personally have read about anywhere, and I've read some pretty bad descriptions of sweatshop labor. It's already taking place. It already behooves us to act against the continued negotiation. And what is making this negotiation successful is the threat of what the Bush administration will do, which is anything, right? So the countries of the Middle East are terrified that if they don't join on, they're going to get their defense money cut and all the weapons that the U.S. sells to Saudi Arabia, for example, or the United States will remove the 5,000 troops that we have in Saudi Arabia, or the United States will invade, or the United States will do whatever it is that the Bush administration is willing to do. And they're signing up quickly so that they will be the first in line to move forward. Also, Robert Zoellick has devised a negotiating stratagem that is working, which is the Free Trade Area of the Americas has been stymied because of the power of social movements and the power of newly elected officials across the region reflecting the views of those social movements to oppose the Free Trade Area of the Americas. And the countries are working together as a bloc. Because the Middle East Free Trade Area is being negotiated as a series of bilateral negotiations, each country individually with the United States, they cannot come together as a bloc. And they are falling by the wayside. The good news is that we are all doing a tremendous amount about this already. And what I talk about in the book in the last chapter, which is the alternatives chapter, is mostly, I give very concrete examples of what we can do to remove the economic invasion and corporate invasion of Iraq as much as the military invasion and how I think that can be achieved. I point to the alternatives to corporate globalization policy, which many of us, I think, are very familiar with in this room. But I also talk about the very successful modes of organizing that we are already doing that we simply, I don't think, embrace enough how successful what we are doing has been. 70% of the American population opposes the president, and nearly that many oppose the war, because they have heard from the U.S. soldiers returning from Iraq, who have come out in very, very increasingly large numbers to tell the truth about what the war is like. The families of those soldiers, the peace and justice movement, the anti-corporate globalization movement, this information that we have spread, this organizing that we have done, has created a place for people to turn once they start having questions. Because of this organizing, because of all the information we have spread, because of the actions that we have taken, the Bush administration is not succeeding in selling the American public the same set of lies about Iran. There is no groundswell of fear in the United States about Iran. There was a groundswell of fear about Iraq. I firmly believe that the reason is because we have spread the information, the soldiers have spread the information, the families have spread the information and the activism and the organizing. And that what we have to do is embrace those successful modes of organizing and keep going and doing more and focusing on the companies and focusing on the lies of the Bush administration and dismantling this agenda. And that I think, I firmly believe that we will succeed. So in that, with that, and with the bell ringing, I'm going to stop and open it up to questions. And I just want to say it's now 8:10. I am going to literally be whisked away to the airport at 8:45. So we're going to have questions and I'm going to sign books. But when I leave, if people are still eager to stay here, that's why I'm not staying. So thank you very much. Thank you. The first thing I want to say, actually, I have two announcements. The first is I have a website, which is maintained masterfully by Sam, which is the structure of which is put in place by my dear friend, who's the name I'm pretty, Radical Designs, your company, I wasn't forgetting your personal name, Radical Designs, which was my dear friend, what is your name again? And Design Action, which designed the website, so visit it, it's thebushagenda.org. I'm currently on tour, and through word of mouth is how people are learning the most about my tour and about my book. So please check out the tour schedule and check out the website. Also on May 15th, there is a tremendous action that's being organized for International Conscientious Objectors Day. And I'm sure David Solnit's gonna pass around some things. This is the poster. And folks should see a poster and see a person. And those are some good organizing to do. Okay, I'm going to take Sam's question because it's just sort of freaking me out. You got a question, Sam?
I was just wondering what Israel's role is in the bilateral agreements that are being
I think you know the answer to that question, Sam. Okay, I'm going to repeat the question. What is the role of Israel in the bilateral negotiations? So, one of the things that has stymied the process of countries, there's two things that have stopped the countries of the Middle East from being sort of rolled into the free trade bandwagon. The first is that they haven't had to. They have a lot of wealth. Unlike countries like Central America, South America, Africa, poor regions that have had to succumb to the policies of the IMF, the World Bank, the WTO, the Middle East has been largely immune because they have money and they haven't had to succumb. Also, to become a member of the World Trade Organization, for example, one has to open up trading relationships with Israel. And many countries in the Middle East have not been eager to do that. The United States has, the Bush administration has forced countries in the Middle East, as part of their participation in the U.S. Middle East Free Trade Area, to sign quizzes. These are quantitative industrial zones. Is that right? Qual? No. It starts with a Q. You have to read the book. It's in the book. It's quiz. I remember the quiz. QIZ. What this is a requirement to do is that each country has to receive duty-free entry for their products into the United States. The products first have to pass through Israel and have some sort of addition made in Israel before the goods can then come into the United States duty-free. So in the case of Jordan, what happens is a shirt gets made in Jordan. It goes to Israel and a label is added. And then it comes to the United States duty-free. There's absolutely no reason for such a provision except for to ensure that Israel has some sort of financial gain in the process. The addition of the quizzes has really added a tremendous amount of opposition to what was already opposition to the free trade negotiations in the Middle East as the negotiations are being made known to people in the Middle East. That's the role of Israel in the free trade negotiations. Okay, so what I'm going to do is take a couple questions at once and then try and group them in my answers. So I'm going to take 1, 2, 3, 4 first.
Okay. As we know, that Iran is at least 10 years away from making a nuclear weapon. If they can make a nuclear weapon, they maintain they're not making a nuclear weapon. Brazil is also embarked on a similar course with no criticism. Israel has nuclear weapons, but it's never discussed. And I was wondering if you could discuss what is, in your view, the Bush agenda with regard to Iran, and what is going on there now? What are they doing?
Sure.
What is their motivation?
Good question. Yeah.
Well, first, just want to thank you for carrying out such important research.
But, thank you.
The one thing I found surprising, I got to flip through the first chapter, but I looked through the index, and there's not one reference to the Democrats or to Kerry, and in fact, you know, used this phrase to the challengers, the oil companies gave to the challengers.
And I didn't name Kerry, did I?
And I wanted to know what role you see the Democrats playing in articulating this economic model, which you see is ultimately lying behind the Bush agenda.
Excellent question. Who was three? Was it Earth?
In terms of a little bit of the history what did you see as the turning point between negotiating, getting close, establishing this relationship, and warfare and the first taking of war?
Mm-hmm.
What was the turning point there if there was something?
Excellent question.
Do you repeat that question?
Yeah, I'll repeat all of them. Yeah.
I have actually two questions. One is the Iranian Bureau right now that the Bureau is replacing dollars and also the increasing the power of China and Russia induced economic balance. And the second point is that some countries, Middle East, from Iran, if 70% of the people oppose the government, it's because something happened. And that's very rare. I think that 70% of the people are opposed to Bush agenda, but it still is a status quo. I wanted to know why is it, why you don't understand the
Good question. Excellent question. Okay, I'm going to take these. First, I'll go in historical order. I did not satisfactorily answer to my own satisfaction. The turning point. What happened in the U.S. relationship with Saddam Hussein, in the Bush administration's senior relationship with Saddam Hussein? There are many theories about what happened, and I go through the theories. The dominant theory in the Middle East is that the United States lured Saddam into the invasion to justify a retaliatory war, to justify the increased military presence of the United States across the region. And that one may argue about whether the United States lured or not, but the reality is certainly there, that the post-first Gulf War reality was a tremendously increased U.S. military presence in the Middle East. 500,000 American troops went into Saudi Arabia in response to Saddam Hussein's incursion into Kuwait. 5,000 U.S. troops remain in Saudi Arabia. We established military bases all across the region. In addition, in response to the second Gulf War, we have significantly, again, increased our military presence in the region, and there are 4 military bases, at least, under permanent construction in Iraq, some say 14. And I think that those who know are not saying yet, and I've read everything that they've written. It seems clear that there was a very firm attempt to develop a solid economic relationship with Saddam Hussein, and that that wasn't seeming to pay off as they wanted it to. And that's what I think happened, and that they decided, and whether, you know, and I don't know, did they let Saddam Hussein invade? Did Saddam Hussein's invasion really make it clear that this guy just wasn't to be trusted or dealt with? I quote a memo from, very well known is the dialogue between April Gillespie, the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, and Saddam Hussein. Less well known was a memo from President Bush to Saddam Hussein saying, hey guy, you know, it's all good. You know, it doesn't really say that. But it would have been really funny if it did. You know, basically to that effect. You know, I know we're having trouble, but it's really okay. And, you know, that was about 5 days before Hussein invaded Kuwait. And so I don't know, but I do think the two things I do know are that this economic relationship was firm, and U.S. corporations were behind it. even to the calls of the Pentagon within both Reagan and Bush Sr.'s administration saying, we shouldn't be fooling around with this guy. He's dangerous. This isn't safe. And the Congress trying to pass sanctions and trying to take action against Saddam Hussein and Reagan and Bush moving forward. Iran. Iran has a lot of oil. Iran used to be our main oil ally after Saudi Arabia in the Middle East. Some folks are probably too young to remember that in 1977, Jimmy Carter spent New Year's Eve with the Shah, that the relationships between the United States and Iran were very, very chummy until that pesky revolution took place. And then we were in search of a new Iran, and Iraq became the new Iran. But we still have never lost our desire to have our old Iran back. And the new Iran is also very much standing in the way of the Bush agenda in the Middle East. And I think that these guys have such clear sights on locking in their corporate access, their political access, that they may in fact be willing to burn their political capital in the United States to achieve it in Iran. And I think we have to be very, very wary of that. It's a very big prize for them, and they seem to be headed after it. The Democrats. I talk a fair amount about Bill Clinton because I spent a lot of my political career in government, out of government, working against the policies of Bill Clinton, particularly his free trade policies. Bill Clinton aggressively pursued and succeeded in creating the North American Free Trade Agreement, the World Trade Organization, expanding the rights of multinational corporations left and right. However, I believe that this administration is markedly different and disastrously different in the way that it is applying its corporate globalization agenda, and that it is important for me as a global justice activist to be very aware of that. That pursuing this agenda through the overt, brutal use of a military invasion, occupation, transformation has deadly effects right there, but it reverberates back. And it makes us very insecure, and it makes many, many people very much dislike us, and has horrific, brutal implications for our soldiers, for Iraqis, for everyone in our way, in a way that I think is markedly different. I think that there are many, particularly Democrats in Congress, my former boss John Conyers one of them, who are doing very good things and have been doing very good things to try and stop the Bush agenda, to try and stop the war, yes, Congressman Conyers, to impeach the president. Congressman Conyers has led that drive. There are many very good policy proposals right now in Congress to take apart the monopoly control of the oil industry, to tax the oil industry, to support alternatives, and I think that the Democrats are doing good work there, and that we need to push them, and we need to push them, and we need to push them farther. And that in the end of the day, I truly believe that anybody is better than these guys. I really do. And that, you know, we'll all be happy with McCain before I'll be happy, you know, with any of these guys. I'll be way happier with other people, but where I have come to sort of summarize this very difficult train of thought, which is sort of difficult for me, is that we have to work for that political change. We have to unseat these guys. But that there is so much more work that we can do on the local level through our social movements, through our collaboration between activists all across the world, that has to happen at the same time. And if we're going to have the type of political influence that turns 70% public opinion into really important, significant policy change, our social movements have to be so powerful and so united that they cannot be ignored. And that one of the most powerful things that happened with the incredible immigrant rights marches that wasn't revealed, and again, I think it's something we have to remind ourselves of regularly, those marches didn't just appear. That was tremendous long-term social organizing on long-standing issues in communities that had worked closely together for years, that were ready to come together and mobilize when they needed to. And that was a response. and that we are part of that response. 350,000 people, I was one of them in New York City a week ago protesting against the war. That is part of that response. We just don't see it, you know, on CNN. And the policy changes slower. And we expect immediate satisfaction. We expect, you know, darn it, if I spent 8 hours on a Saturday marching, the next day the war should be over. You know, not always. And there's a lot more that goes into the type of change, you know, that we need to see. But I think there is, I mean, this is a much longer dialogue, and you raise a very important question. There is something decidedly different about social change in the United States from Europe. And that I know that there must be wonderful books on these shelves that talk about it more than I can do right now. Okay, I'm going to take one last set of questions and then probably sign books. One, it depends on how many questions there are, so raise your hand if you're going to have a question. This woman in the back, then you, and then you.
Would you please repeat the questions as they're asked?
Oh, I forgot to do that. I apologize. Yeah.
Maybe people who are asking the questions can stand up.
Okay. So please stand up. Next, who is the next question? Yeah.
How badly do you think that the public has been, the whole thing with peak oil, I think that the estimates of the oil-producing countries, especially Saudi Arabia, are way inflated. Mm. And how much is that affecting the policy that's being driven by the Bush administration?
You mean the amount?
In other words, a while back, they were allowed to pump out based on a percentage of what they said they had as reserves. Mm-hmm. Well, when that rule, before that rule came into effect, all of a sudden the reserves just shot up.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
How much is driving the Bush administration and the oil companies on that?
Okay.
Yeah. Do you see a connection, any kind of significant connection between the religious right, that whether they be rapturist or non-rapturist, and the corporatists that are the engines moving in the Middle East?
Good question. Yes.
I don't know because I haven't read your book, but what's the Bush agenda with Venezuela and with South America, you know?
Mm-hmm. There's another one, yeah, back there.
Yeah, I had a question on the role of, you know, voter fraud in trying to, you know, get this administration out. And
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's so widely known that I find out even more and more
yeah, no, absolutely. Okay. Anyone else? Okay, good. I mean, not that there's anyone else. Okay. What is going to be a surprise to many members of Congress is the extensive restructuring of the Iraqi economy under the Bremer orders. No matter what, I know that is a surprise. Because, for example, my writing on the Bremer orders has been posted on a website for U.S. companies seeking to operate in Iraq to better understand the new economic conditions in Iraq. You can read Antonia Juhas's work on the Bremer orders. That was a little surprise. Yeah, I'm the only one that's really done it, and they really haven't been exposed. And if you read L. Paul Bremer's book, you would be surprised to learn that there was anything known as a Bremer order. He is very, very humble and doesn't mention the fact that he restructured the Iraqi economy. And understanding the Bremer orders is crucial to understanding what's taking place right now in Iraq, understanding why we are having such a difficult time holding the corporations accountable. One very important point on that, in addition, there are apparently some 50 suits that have been leveled against U.S. corporations for their work in Iraq. However, these are being leveled under a legal device where individual citizens can sue a company on behalf of the federal government if it feels that the federal government has been defrauded by those companies. In order for those cases to move forward, the federal government has to decide if it's going to join or not in the suit. The federal government, the Bush administration, hasn't decided. So that means that the suits sit and they are secret. Say that 10 times fast. They are secret because they are still being decided on by the government. So that this is a tremendous, this has not happened before, and the federal government faces this situation all the time. This is a tremendous abuse, obviously, of the democratic system, and I don't think that members of Congress are fully aware that this is happening, and we can't even find out what the suits are, much less have them dealt with. Also, the fact, even among the U.S. Congress, that there are hundreds of Iraqi companies, private and public, more than capable of doing the reconstruction if they simply had the money, which makes the solving of the restructuring much more simple. If you can simply bypass the American companies, kick out the American companies, in particular, kick out the economic transformers, the millions and millions of dollars that we're spending just to send Bearing Point back into Iraq. Bearing Point had their contract renewed recently to focus exclusively on privatization, and we're paying for that. That's a lot of money that can be saved. Those are contracts that simply just need to be canceled, and that is money that needs to be restructured, resent in to the Iraqi public. In addition, there is almost no concrete awareness on the U.S. Middle East free trade area. I will tell you, as a congressional staff person, there is very little awareness of trade, much less how it works, much less what the downsides are, much less what the Congress can do about it. And the U.S. Middle East free trade area is zipping by because the administration is still negotiating it under the shield of the war on terror. So there was the Dubai ports scandal. It had such a limited effect on what's actually happening in these negotiations. There is currently a U.S.-UAE free trade agreement being negotiated. It's moving forward briskly. And the Dubai port scandal was a short attempt by the Republicans to say, we don't do everything he tells us to, you should reelect us, without any significant transformation in their policy. And that this is something that our elected officials have to hear from us on. I also think that the relationship between the companies and the administration may not be a surprise to elected officials, but it's something that they need to hear from us on. So 16 members of Lockheed, of executives present and past of Lockheed Martin are members of the current Bush administration. 16. That is a tremendous link. And it's not surprising, therefore, that Lockheed Martin has seen its stocks increase, have tripled since the invasion. Halliburton stocks have tripled. Chevron has had its most profitable years in its 125-year history. Chevron gets away with murder, literally, because everybody is focused on Exxon. They're big, and they deserve to be focused on. But Chevron's really big, too, just in comparison to Exxon's $36 billion. Their $14 billion look small, but if you just looked at their $14 billion, they'd look pretty big. The links between these companies and this administration, Cheney, this was Sam's discovery. This was a great discovery. Dick Cheney owns stock in both Lockheed Martin and Halliburton. He's doing really well. He's really good at it. This type of information, I think, empowers people and needs to be shared. Okay, the surprise, I like that one. Peak oil and all the myths around oil. That is a much longer discussion. But let me just say this in a short answer. The five largest oil companies in the United States produce more oil every day than Saudi Arabia exports. They control supply. They are so concentrated, they have such monopoly, vertical and horizontal control, that they control production, exploration, production, marketing, refining, sales. They control refining to such a degree that they limit the amount of gas we have by limiting how much oil they refine into gas. For every dollar of gasoline at the pump, 15% is the cost of a barrel of crude oil, about 25% is taxes, 30% is marketing, refining, and profits, because the same company does marketing and refining and sales, they control 30% of every dollar. The Bush administration is allowing and increasing this concentration. So just during the Bush administration's term, Chevron, Texaco, Unocal, one company, ConocoPhillips, one company. There are significantly more mergers, but I forget all the names of all the companies. And that is a problem, both in terms of our supply and access to oil and the pricing of oil, but also, you know, I think most importantly, in terms of our democracy. When ExxonMobil earns more money in a single year than any corporation has ever earned in world history, that gives them undue influence over our elected officials. And that limits our ability to influence our officials. And I think one other quick thing on oil, I think it's really important to puncture the myth of the tremendously reduced supply coming out of Iraq, because that's another way that oil companies are justifying high profits. Before the war, Iraqi oil production was 2.5 million barrels per day. Today it's 2.2 million barrels per day. It's less, but it's not, you know, the nothing that I think we're imagining. And U.S. oil companies are receiving more of that oil and shipping more of that oil to the United States as a result of the war. I don't know about the connection between, who asked this question, the religious right and the corporations. I would be very interested in learning about such a connection. And if anyone knows the answer to that, please share it with us. Between the religious right and U.S. corporations. Yeah. Kevin Phillips' book. Does it discuss this topic? Yeah. Theocracy. American Theocracy. Kevin Phillips is wonderful. I haven't read the new book yet, but I highly recommend everything that he writes. So, okay, the role of Venezuela in South America. I focus on the book on oil in Africa and oil in the Middle East, and the reason why is because the Bush administration focuses so concretely on oil in the Middle East. The reason why is the Middle East has the vast majority of the world's oil. Venezuela definitely has a lot of oil. Venezuela is definitely pissing off the Bush administration. The Bush administration has already tried to take down the government of Venezuela. I think they will continue to do so. And I think that in the president's latest national security strategy, there is particularly and uniquely harsh language about Venezuela this time around. I think Venezuela is in their sights, and we should have that in our sights as well. And finally, voter fraud. The reason why I think that we have to be so aggressively cognizant of our constant social organizing, our social movements, our ability, and I'm looking at Patrick for this, to move beyond voting and to look at our organizing beyond the short-term elections, is because of this very reason, because of things like voter fraud, because of the amount of disempowerment that people feel when they say, it doesn't even matter what I do when I go into the voting booths. Now, first of all, there are tremendous movements working on solving these problems, of solving the problems of Diebold, of solving the problems of what's happening in our voting booths, of solving the problems of corporate involvement in our campaigns. And these movements need to be supported, and they're doing critically important work. And at the same time, we have to strengthen our social movements, our social organizing, so that ultimately it doesn't matter what they're doing with Diebold, because we're going to be able to influence policy the way we want to influence change the way we want to, and to expose everything dirty that they do so that it gets fixed and it's clean. Now I'm going to end with that. Thank you all very, very, very much. And then I have time for